Hello, this is Guardian Daily. It's Monday the 21st of September, and I'm Michael White in Bournemouth for the annual conference of the Liberal Democrats. I've been coming to them since Scarborough in 1975. This year, delegates are busy distancing themselves from David Cameron's weekend overtures, most unwelcome to them.
I genuinely don't know what George Osborne and David Cameron believe, other than this sense of entitlement that people like them should run the country.
And I'm Mike Duran in London. In today's other stories, will President Obama's nuclear doctrine really change the world? What's big in Japan? I'll tell you, the trend to rent a friend. Plus, extra time torment for City as Michael Owen steals the Manchester Derby. First, a news update and front page review with Bill Overton.
The wage bill for all civil servants should be frozen, according to the Liberal Democrat Treasury spokesman Vince Cable. In his speech to the party conference in Bournemouth today, he'll warn only tough and unpopular decisions will work in paying off the national debt. But he believes freezing the pay bill for what he calls a culture of massively inflated salaries would be better than cutting public services. And business leaders argue students should pay more to reduce the government's deficit. The CBI expects there to be a shortfall in funding for higher education and recommends making students pay as much as £5,000 a year for their tuition. They also want to cut down the number of grants and increase the interest charged on student loans. The bosses do feel they should contribute a bit more themselves by offering students with science degrees golden handshakes when they start work. More than 35 million people are suffering from dementia around the world, according to a report from King's College London. The authors also expect the numbers will double every 20 years to reach 115 million by 2050. The United Nations talks on climate change are almost at deadlock, claims the president of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso. He says developing nations are very reluctant to play their part in cutting emissions. The UN will hold a one-day summit of leaders in New York on Tuesday. The former British Prime Minister Tony Blair has offered one solution to help negotiations in a report on climate change. He says 10 million new green jobs could be created. The big British success at the Emmy Awards in the USA was the BBC's production of Little Dorrit. It won seven trophies, including the award for an outstanding miniseries. Now, the morning papers, The Times and Telegraph, lead with student grants. Middle-class students should pay more is The Telegraph's take on the CBI recommendation, which The Times calls a triple whammy on students. It points out only families earning less than £38,000 a year could get grants for student living costs. The Telegraph says university vice-chancellors welcome the ideas. Our paper has an exclusive report on Barack Obama's plans for defence, which he'll take to the UN General Assembly this week. Official sources have told us that he's ready to slash America's nuclear arsenal. We'll have more detail later in Guardian Daily. The Financial Times has what it considers good news on global warming. It says the recession has resulted in an unparalleled fall in greenhouse gas emissions. The International Energy Agency then tells the paper there's a great opportunity to move the world away from high carbon growth as industry gears itself up again. The red tops go entirely their own ways. The Sun has a front page scoop reporting the son of former Health Minister Patricia Hewitt has been charged with possessing cocaine. The Mirror leads with an interview with the new Strictly Come Dancing judge Alicia Dixon, who's been heavily criticised for not being good enough. The headline reads, "I won't quit." There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
When the Lib Dems were in conference a year ago, Lehman Brothers collapsed in New York, bringing the financial system of the world close to the brink. Vince Cable was a star of that week, a Lib Dem spokesman on economics, good enough to be quoted on all the TV bulletins. Well, he's back here in a quieter week, we hope, speaking today about election policy and cuts, which have hovered over this conference as they will over the Tory and Labour in weeks to come. How are they going to cut? How they're going to do it. Nick Clegg seemed to be going further than Vince over the weekend. We'll hear from Cable today, and our chief political correspondent, Nick Watt, has got a flavour of what he may say.
Well, I'm standing on the seafront at Bournemouth, and the Liberal Democrats are waiting for one of the main moments of their party conference, and indeed, I think we can say one of the main moments of the entire British party conference season. That is the speech by Vince Cable. Now, normally, a speech by the Liberal Democrat Treasury spokesman is not one of the great British highlights, but it is here because Vince Cable, of course, is the man who predicted the recession really better than anyone else. So we all listen. Everyone listens to what he says with enormous care. And I think his speech to the conference today is going to be pretty tough for this party, because it's not that long ago that this party thought really the way to go about things was to tax and to spend. That used to be associated with old Labour. 10 years ago, it was associated with the Liberal Democrats. Those days are over. Vince Cable and Nick Clegg are saying the public finances are in an utterly dire position. We have to be honest with people. We have to level with people and say that times are going to be tough. And one of the main things that Vince Cable is going to outline today is he's going to say that there should be a freeze of the entire public sector pay budget. That would save £2.4 billion a year and would be pretty tough for public sector workers. Now, what he will say is this won't mean pay freezes across the board. What he will say is the budget will be frozen, and within that, hopefully, you could direct pay increases at the lower paid by trimming the wages of the better paid public sector workers. And this will be particularly interesting about where this places the Liberal Democrats in the political spectrum, because this is the Liberal Democrats saying we will go further than Labour, and significantly we, the Liberal Democrats, who were once seen as the most left-wing party, will go further in cuts than the Tories, which is quite a position to be in. And Nick Clegg and Vince Cable, they really see David Cameron as a bit of a poser. David Cameron tried to love bomb them over the weekend, and they're saying, well, he's talked about cuts, hasn't outlined any plans. We're not only talking about them, we're outlining some pretty clear plans.
Nick Watt there on Vince Cable. Now, on Sunday, remarks by David Cameron, the Tory leader, trying to cosy up to Lib Dems and probably to their voters, didn't go down well at all in the conference hall.
Nick, how will our party reply to the Conservatives' overtures to attract Liberal votes and thereby make clear the differences between us and the Conservatives?
I think it's relatively simple. We all know we want change. The country wants change, right? That bit's clear. We all know that Labour's run out of road, knackered, exhausted, hollowed out. Sort of, they seem to be always crying out for the kind of relief of opposition. So we all know that the country wants a change. So the question then is, what change? And ask people, do you trust the change offered to you by David Cameron? And I would say it's kind of difficult to trust the change he's offering. He talks about a broken Britain, and then their only tax policies are a great big tax break for the super rich. Talk about, as we've said earlier, looking after the environment and then club together with climate change deniers in Europe. Talk about a new politics and won't even tell you whether their principal donors pay full British taxes in this country or not. Talk about how the Conservatives are going to responsibly deal with the structural fiscal deficit, and the most eye-catching idea is putting up the price of salads in the House of Commons.
While all that was happening, I stopped some of the delegates in the hall, and Somerset MP David Heath as well, to ask whether there was really more than a cigarette paper between them and the Tories.
I think it's absolutely ridiculous. We're a completely different party with completely different principles. Cameron, well, it's just like Nick Clegg was saying last night, Cameron put the con back in Conservative. We don't believe he's going to keep the promises he's making. The Liberal Democrats will keep the promises. We believe in what we're saying, and we believe in change.
What's the difference? When you think of that, what's the big policy difference? Is it economic, civil liberties, environment?
Definitely the environment. And like the Greenpeace, they rated us the most green party out of all of them. Our economic policies are completely different. What George Osborne, compared to what Vince Cable is proposing, is absolutely completely different.
My colleagues from The Guardian, we're asking people, when David Cameron says, not a cigarette paper between me and Nick Clegg, it probably makes you cross. Why?
It's not true, because they've got an appalling record on civil liberties. They voted for the Iraq War. They haven't got the policy we have about 15 children per primary school class, and so on and so on.
I think the Lib Dems have got real values, and they've got things they really believe in, and I can't see that with their things like liberty, the core, the ideas behind children. And the belief in children, the belief in children's development, and access and opportunity for children, which was mentioned yesterday.
What makes you think Cameron, all the trouble he's been through with his own family losing it, doesn't he believe in children?
I wouldn't say he doesn't believe in them, but it doesn't come clear to me as a key policy objective. You know, it's not really obvious to me, and perhaps I don't know enough about his policy, and perhaps I don't know enough about the Conservatives, but it's not loud and clear. And I work in education, and children are very important to me.
When David Cameron says there's not a cigarette paper between him and Nick Clegg, what's your reaction, David Heath?
My reaction is that there certainly have been a massive cigarette papers between the Conservatives and us over the years, and if they are masquerading at the moment as Liberal Democrats, then so be it. But it is literally paper thin, and the reality is that it's the same old Tory party under different colours.
What do you think of immediately when you try to differentiate between you and the Tories at the moment?
I think there's a whole lot of instinctive things. I mean, I cannot take seriously a party which is now proclaiming its opposition to ID cards but voted for them. I can't take seriously a party which says that the answer to the enormous fiscal deficit we've got is to increase the price of salads in the House of Commons bar rather than look at matters such as Trident. You know, there are real serious issues where the Tories simply aren't in the argument.
So why is he saying it?
Because he wants to make sure that as many people as possible are confused into thinking that they can safely vote Conservative. After the election, the veneer will come off.
And it's Liberal Dem votes as he wants to get back, isn't it?
It's Liberal Democrat votes who are genuine Liberal Democrat votes who they think they can dislodge by saying that, you can afford to do this because really there's no difference. Unfortunately, the reality is, look at the way Conservative councils behave, look at the way that Conservatives in government behave. There is a world of difference between the two.
Who controls the local authority in your part of the West Country?
The Conservatives.
And how does the local party, how does Cameron go down in your constituency?
Well, look, this is going to sound terribly yokelish and very Somerset.
Oh, go on, but, do it anyway.
But, well, I have to say it anyway. I mean, I think country people can spot a fake. They're swatting a fake.
Now, while David Heath was speaking then, the noise level rose in the background because Nick Clegg has just finished doing a Q&A, very articulate he was too, in the main conference hall, very crowded, unusually crowded, I must say, for the first day of, or second day, strictly speaking, of a Lib Dem conference on a Sunday afternoon. It's normally half full. It was full today. They've all poured out. But we think the Oxford scientist and militant atheist, Professor Richard Dawkins, is talking in there at the moment. So maybe it's a vote for faith, or maybe it's just that people want a cup of tea.
It's a lamentable observation that because of the way our laws are skewed towards the plaintiff, London has become the libel capital of the world. Litigants are coming to England from another country to sue people who live in a third country over a book that was published in a fourth country, the excuse being that a handful of books were also sold here. A nice little round-the-world jaunt for lawyers it may be, but sensible or liberal it is not, nor is it just. Of course there must be redress if you are maliciously attacked in a way that damages you. But if such a law is cast too wide, it has disastrous consequences on the public interest, not least in the area of science and medicine, where the stakes are high, profits and reputations are guarded jealously, and the vulnerable need to be protected from unproven or fraudulent claims for cures, whether by alternative therapists or big pharmaceuticals.
Professor Richard Dawkins there. Afterwards, I caught up with Evan Harris, MP for Oxford West, and asked him whether Dawkins was a constituent of his as well as a fellow sceptic.
Well, I'm a secularist. I believe in separation of religion and the state. I don't really mind what people believe in. He is a constituent, and he tells me he votes for me, but then everyone says to an MP that they vote for him. And he's being given permission to introduce an amendment today for us to adopt policies to reform our libel laws, because London's the libel capital of the world, and a lot of dodgy people from abroad come to sue journalists in London when they shouldn't have that right.
But he's the man who's interested in this, if I've got this right, the science angle of laws of libel, not pop stars and crooked businessmen. He says this inhibits scientific debate. Have I got that right?
That's right, that's part of it. But the campaign for reform of the libel law, which I've been involved in, is not just about science, although we need to have room to discuss evidence, the evidence base for things, without vested interests, whether they be pharmaceutical companies or alternative practitioners suing people who criticise them for their lack of evidence.
Like Ben Goldacre, the Guardian's bad science man, is taken to the doors of the High Court last year by some quack doctor from South Africa who bottled out at the last moment.
Yeah, and indeed, using the words like quack doctor are the...
Sorry, I didn't say that, Mr. Lawyer.
Exactly the sorts of things that in this country create worry, because you get letters. Even if you eventually win the case, you lose, because you're usually thousands of pounds down and it's a year of your life gone. The Guardian's been a real victim of this, actually, with Tesco and with the unsuccessful attempt on Ben Goldacre. So it is important that this is wider than science, it's wider than journalism, and that's why the campaign is supported by authors and entertainers as well.
Well, quite a lively first full day of the Liberal Democrat conference there. It can be a bit quiet, but no, we've had Ed Davey, the foreign affairs spokesman, telling us that even the Taliban and Mr. Karzai are all moving in the direction of Lib Dem policy. They're talking about coalition. Not sure if he's right about that, but he did say it. And Tavish Scott said that, contrary to what Nick Clegg wants to do, cut those middle class benefits like child benefit, tax credit. That wicked SNP administration in Scotland is giving the middle class and the upper classes in Scotland £1 billion worth of perks. That's care for the elderly and free prescriptions, that sort of thing. Plenty of excitement going on here. And the weather's been not half bad. Between now and talking to you again tomorrow, I plan to go into the sea. I'll report back.
The Guardian's assistant editor Michael White reporting from the Lib Dem conference in Bournemouth. Other news now. We look ahead to this week's historic United Nations Security Council session. President Obama will be in the chair, pushing his progressive agenda for consensus on nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation. All 15 members of the Security Council could attend, including Libya's President Gaddafi, fresh from his controversial welcome to the Lockerbie bomber Abdel Bassett al-Megrahi on arrival in Libya following his compassionate release. Earlier this year, Obama tasked the Pentagon with updating America's nuclear deterrent options. His defense staff came back with a plan which was little changed from the Bush years. The president told them to go away and be more radical. He wants to cut nuclear warheads from more than 2,000 to just a few hundred. This Thursday, we'll see how well his proposals are received in New York, as our diplomatic editor, Julian Borger, explains.
President Obama has rejected the first draft from the Pentagon and demanded much more radical rethink. What he's demanding is to be presented with a range of options of a U.S. nuclear deterrent that gives him the choice of setting the doctrine and setting long-term numbers and nuclear stance of the years to come, rather than leaving it in the hands of the Pentagon. This is really a question of president wresting control of the process away from the men in uniforms.
And radical would be a word, wouldn't it, if what we hear is correct, that he wants to cut the number from over 2,000 warheads to just a few hundred?
What's happening at the moment is that the present ceiling of deployed warheads agreed with Russia is 2,200. Now, the deal that's being negotiated at the moment with Moscow would bring that to 1,500 deployed strategic weapons. What this administration wants to do is use that not as an end, but as a beginning to further talks that would bring that number of deployed strategic warheads down into the hundreds rather than thousands. And that would mean reconfiguring the U.S. nuclear force, rearranging it, rethinking it, rethinking what it's for, and redesigning it. So these are radical ideas, but of course this is the president that has declared his ultimate aim of working towards a world without nuclear weapons. He's committed to abolishing nuclear weapons over the long term.
And domestically for the president, how well is his, I guess we could describe it as a unilateral stance, going down with his critics?
It's definitely not unilateral. This is a good point to make, that it is definitely a multilateral effort. He wants the U.S. to be a leader in a multilateral process in which the weapons states, existing weapons states, agree to radical disarmament in return for the non-weapons states agreeing to continue to forego nuclear weapons. This is the basic bargain behind the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that's up for review next year. It's showing signs of coming apart under the pressure of Iran and North Korea gaining weapons and a general dissatisfaction with the lack of disarmament from the weapons states. So what Obama is trying to do is address that dissatisfaction and try and repair the non-proliferation treaty in time for next year so that the spread of nuclear weapons around the world can be curbed and drawn back.
Now, Obama is chairing the UN Security Council later this week, isn't he? That's in New York. How do you think the plans will go down there?
Well, there's a resolution that's going through the draft stages, and it doesn't talk about abolishing nuclear weapons. It talks about creating the conditions for a world without nuclear weapons. That's the best they could do. But officials involved in organizing this Security Council meeting, this extraordinary Security Council meeting on nuclear weapons, so the important thing is that both weapons states and non-weapon states will be involved. 15 members of the Security Council will come together with a joint statement that points the world back in the direction of this bargain. The weapon states give up their weapons, the non-weapon states agree to stop pursuing them.
Julian Borgia. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, the big organic fight back starts as sales collapse by up to a third. Details at guardian.co.uk/business. There's the confused future for airport security at guardian.co.uk/transport, plus the A-list are back at London Fashion Week. Pictures and comment at guardian.co.uk/lifeandstyle. I'm Mike Durant. Still to come on today's Guardian Daily, Man City shows its strength in a dramatic derby at Old Trafford. Before that, to a growing phenomenon in Japan, where if you're lonely and friendless, don't worry, you can always rent a friend. The I Want to Make You Happy agency is just part of a growing sector in phony friends. Among its portfolio, it offers women the opportunity to hire a handsome boyfriend to make their ex jealous. The out of work can impress future employees by renting a bogus boss. Or you can buy a best man for your wedding. Our Tokyo correspondent, Justin McCurry, has been following the development.
The I Want to Make You Happy agency is one of about 10 agencies, most of them in Tokyo, that have sprouted up over the last few years in Japan. And what they do is rent out agents who pose as, well, any sort of, they play any number of roles, really, but most of the time they pose as colleagues or fathers or mothers, uncles, aunties, or just simply friends at social functions, things like weddings, funerals. But also events on a smaller scale. They'll pretend to be the father of a child taking part in a sports day. They might pretend to be the mother and father of a woman who's attending a formal matchmaking party. They might even pretend to be the girlfriend of a single guy who's having trouble finding a real girlfriend, but who needs to perhaps show the pretense of having a girlfriend at some sort of party or other social event. So there's any number of situations in which these phony friends and colleagues will stand in. They obviously have to do their homework before they make their appearance. If they answer a question incorrectly, or if they clam up and can't answer a question, say something that exposes them as a fraud, then of course that business is not going to do particularly well, and the client is going to be hugely embarrassed. So it's complicated, it's intricate, but judging by the coverage in the Japanese media and the growth of these agencies, it seems to work.
The idea of taking a casual friend, girlfriend or boyfriend, to an occasion doesn't seem quite so extraordinary, but hiring somebody to cheer on your own children at their school sports day, knowing how paranoid we are as a nation, you can see tabloids here calling this a pervert's charter, can't you?
Well, I suppose you could. You have to remember that, for example, the agent that I interviewed for the Guardian story in today's newspaper was asked to pose as the uncle of two young children by their mother. And the reason for that was that the mother's divorced. The children had been bullied at school about, what was going on at home. And she thought that to have, at least a male figure or a male member of the family to cheer the children on, to take part in the adult and child races later on in the afternoon, would sort of offer her kids some moral support and perhaps even stop the bullying. It's a business transaction. The agents are also not allowed to break the law, of course. I mean, they're not allowed to turn up at a wedding and say that they work as a policeman or as a lawyer, or that they have academic qualifications that they don't have, or that they work for one of the ministries, because those are all minor offences. It's highly irregular as a social service, but it is regulated quite strictly by the agencies themselves. There certainly haven't been any cases of those agencies getting in trouble with the police.
And you mentioned the wedding. It seems extraordinary, doesn't it, that you can hire a complete stranger to do your best man speech?
That's right. I think the weddings are in many ways the most interesting aspect of all of this, because there are two reasons why I think this sort of phony, the idea of inviting phony friends to weddings has taken off. The first is economic. There are more people unemployed now in Japan than there were. In fact, unemployment's at a record high at the moment. People are more likely to perform sort of contract work, so they're never in the same workplace for long enough to make genuine friends among their colleagues. To spare themselves embarrassment, they'll simply contact one of these agencies who could send, you know, between 1 and 100 people to the wedding party just to make up the numbers. And of course, if there are several agents, they can mix among themselves and be sort of less conspicuous that way. The other reason is sort of social. I mean, there's a sort of cultural resistance to airing one's dirty laundry in public in Japan. And I think, you know, in the case of a woman who asks an agent to act as her children's uncle at a sports day, for example, you know, rather than say, well, I'm divorced, mind your own business, being a single parent is absolutely nothing to be ashamed of, they would rather sort of get in touch with one of these agencies and spare their blushes in that way. So there's, you know, there are deep-seated economic and cultural reasons for this. And it has actually started to spread to South Korea as well. There are similar agencies there. Although I don't think I can imagine this kind of industry taking off in the UK.
Finally then, Justin, in the spirit of things, how much would it cost me for you to be my friend?
I'll gladly turn up for the entire afternoon and the evening party for about 15,000 yen, which is getting on for £100. But if you want me to make a speech and sing karaoke afterwards, it'll cost you more.
Justin McCurry. Finally, Sir Alex Ferguson will have chewed his way through several sticks of gum during his team's tense derby with Manchester City. In the 90th minute, City's Craig Bellamy levelled the score to 3-3. But then a substituted Michael Owen grabbed the win in the 6th minute of extra time. Also worthy of mention, Rooney and Fletcher for United, Tevez and Given for City. The Guardian's Jonathan Wilson joins us, and there are going to be questions over the extended extra time.
Oh, definitely. I mean, to score in the 6th minute of added time, it's very hard to know where that came from. I mean, yes, there were 4 goals in the second half before the winner, and I guess you add on a little bit for each of those and the time the celebration takes, but there were no lengthy injuries. It's difficult to think of a trainer even coming on in the second half. So hard to understand where those 6-7 minutes came from.
Let's talk about that final goal then. This is why Ferguson picked Owen, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly how he sees him. I mean, maybe he'll use him from the start against lesser teams in Premier League. But I think his real value these days is an impact substitute coming on 15, 20 minutes to go when you need a goal. United were dominant for much of the second half, but were struggling to score, and that's what Owen gives you. He is still a great finisher, whatever faults he has in his game these days. And it was, you know, a great finish from little more than a half chance.
Well, let's talk about City before we go on to some of the other goals. Are they, on reflection, title challengers now?
I'm not sure they're title challengers, but I think they're certainly good challengers for the top four. But I think you've got to bear in mind today they were playing without Adebayor, and he is crucial to their system. And his absence was felt almost sorely because of them having no Roque Santa Cruz, who's still injured. And that, I think, really, it's where Adebayor's idiocy last week is really being felt, that he's ruled himself out of this game by the stamp on Robin van Persie by getting the 3-game ban, and they don't have a natural replacement. And that means not having that big target man figure up front, there's no outlet ball. So you saw in the second half as United forced a string of corners and free kicks, two of which they scored from. City couldn't get the ball out. They just kept coming back and the pressure kept mounting. Yeah, that was a big tactical problem for them, not having him. And yet, they still came very close to getting a very good point at Old Trafford.
Some excellent goals, Rooney's being the first one of the match. What about the goalkeeper, Shea Given? He was maybe man of the match for some.
Yeah, I mean, made 2 excellent saves from Berbatov headers, and the contrast with Ben Foster, I think, is pretty obvious. I think, you know, we were all thinking, we're all hoping that when Ben Foster finally got himself fit, he would become the obvious choice to be England's goalkeeper in the World Cup next summer. And I think we've seen this season that unless there's a dramatic improvement, he may not even make the squad. I think you'd criticise him for the first goal when he allowed himself to be dispossessed by Tevez before he laid it back to Gareth Barry. And certainly that third goal, the Bellamy goal in the 90th minute, he seem to go down a little early, let Bellamy go around him, and being beaten on a near post is a classic mistake.
Do you think that Foster has done himself some long-term damage?
When a goalkeeper's coming back after an injury, you never quite know, is he fully fit? Is his confidence fully there? And with a goalkeeper, obviously, confidence is absolutely essential, even more than other positions. So I guess the problem for him is when Van der Sar's fit, he will make way for Van der Sar. So it's then very hard for him to get pitch time to kind of convince Fabio Capello to pick him. And this really was his opportunity. These games when Van der Sar's out, if he'd played well, if he'd made himself, it's obvious number one, he'd had a chance to impress Capello. But I think what we've seen of him, he does seem prone to errors.
Jonathan Wilson. And for details of other matches, log on to guardian.co.uk/sport. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Producing today, Ian Chambers and Tim Mabey in London. Phil Maynard with Michael White in Bournemouth. I'm Mike Durant. Thanks for listening.